Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Oh, there they are.
Where?
They're over here, so they're...
Hang on a second. Is that you, Ethan?
Yeah. That voice you hear is me swearing because we, CBC reporter Georgie Smythe and I, just spotted a pod of whales in the water near our boat just off Vancouver Island.
Do you see them to the left?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. So how close were they?
Close, but not close enough for my taste, or at least not similar to how you maybe imagine in the movies. So Fisheries and Oceans Canada has rules for how close you can get to whales, even for research purposes. So we were maybe like 400 meters away. At first, all I could see was the perspiration of their blows hanging in the air, but then we saw the dorsal fins climbing out of the water, and it was so cool.
I bet. That's still pretty close. You know, I was tempted to pay big money last summer to go whale watching when we were visiting Vancouver Island, but we didn't take the plunge. So, Ethan, I'm pretty jealous that you had this experience. You're pretty lucky. Clearly not a typical day at the office.
No, I don't know if that was an accidental pun there, but we did get to take the plunge. And no, it was not anything like my normal day working for CBC.
Okay, so before we get into why you were out there looking for whales, instead of being in the newsroom, why don't you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Yeah, of course. So hi, everybody. I'm Ethan Sawyer. I'm a producer with CBC News here in Vancouver.
And I should let listeners know, I'm Leisha Grabinski. I am filling in this week for Laura Lynch. This is What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. This week, we're looking for solutions in the lakes and grasslands of my home province of Saskatchewan, and asking whether satirizing oil and gas executives can turn laughter into action. But first, how to help whales survive warmer waters. And Ethan, this amazing experience has a real purpose. You mentioned that this was for research. What's going on here?
Yeah. So before we get to the research, I should probably just apologize to my mom for swearing on the public broadcaster. As I mentioned, it's just not every day that you get to see whales for a story like this. But to answer your question, we got to tag along with a group of researchers who were looking for whales in the Salish Sea. And a lot more whales than normal have been spotted in these waters in recent years, and the group thinks it might be because of climate change. So they're hoping that some new research techniques will provide more answers that might, you know, help us understand how climate change is impacting these beautiful, iconic animals.
So listening to these sounds, I feel like I'm right there with you. But where exactly did you go for this?
Yeah, so this was in the waters off of Hornby Island, which is here in British Columbia. It was still pretty cold when we got there. You know, there was snow on the mountaintops, but the water was super clear and calm, and the whole area was really, really quiet, especially down where we were at an area called Ford's Cove. It takes a bit of effort to get to that part of the province. It took us 3 ferries just to get to Hornby, and yet, you know, this area is part of the Northern Gulf Islands, and they're really popular with tourists in the spring and summer. And a big draw is all the sea life, like the humpback and killer whales that, you know, swim in the waters nearby.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about the climate change impact and the research technique. But first, when you say a lot more whales, what kinds are we talking about?
Yeah, so the whales that you heard us rushing to see there are what's commonly known as transient killer whales. You can think of them as sort of nomads. They travel around. They're also known as Biggs killer whales. But transient killer whales aren't alone in this part of the Pacific Ocean. The northern and southern resident killer whales are also there, and humpbacks are in the water too, and they've had an increased presence during the fall and winter lately.
And so is this unusual for all these different whales to be hanging out in this area at this time of year?
For some of them, yes, definitely. The southern resident killer whales used to be seen in the Salish Sea every day, you know, spring, summer, and fall. Now they can be gone for months in the summer. But researchers say transient killer whales are spending much more time here, even, you know, compared to 15 years ago. They used to be seen much less frequently, and now they can be seen almost every day, and it's not entirely clear why. Last year, this group of researchers set out during the winter to try and learn more. The hope is that by learning what's driving the behavior of these whales, they might be able to help them, since the populations for so many are struggling.
So what does climate change and warming waters mean for these animals?
Yeah, so the researchers say we're still in the early stages of uncovering exactly how climate change plays into all of this. For example, you might have heard that humpback whales are having a comeback in this region, but there are models that suggest their breeding grounds could soon actually become too warm. And if that happens, it could be really bad news for future generations. Okay, Alicia, do you remember the blob, that hot spot in the North Pacific?
Of course I do.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do. It's a little anxiety-inducing. Well, the researchers say that caused a huge drop in the number of humpback whales. So basically, a bunch of young whales died, and warming water could also affect zooplankton, which are an important food source for many whales, meaning they could be experiencing nutritional stress.
So that sounds concerning. Let's get to the specifics of this study and the group of researchers behind it.
Yeah, so it's a group that is pretty well known here in BC. They're called Oceanwise, and they're a conservation group headquartered in Vancouver.
Good morning.
This is our director, Chloe.
Hi, nice to meet
you.
And so Oceanwise is, you know, quite a large group, but there were about five of them doing this research. We spoke mostly with this guy, Gary Sutton, who is honestly maybe the biggest whale lover I've ever met. Like, if a whale took human form and started researching other whales, that's Gary. That's his whole vibe. But he was leading us through everything while we were visiting Hornby Island. But we also had a chance to chat with some of his teammates, ask them questions about why they're gathering data on this trip. The whole thing was sort of focused on this thing called eDNA.
And what is eDNA?
Yeah, so basically it's all in the name, environmental DNA, which is to say DNA gathered in the environment.
Ready? Okay. And go.
Got it.
Okay.
And so in this case, you know, the team is using plastic jugs and scoopers, similar to what you see for swimming pools, and they are scooping up water and gathering it. Here's Gary explaining more.
It's like CSI in the ocean. So instead of biopsying the animals, which is historically how you'd get any genetic information from them, by taking a spring-loaded dart and taking a blubber sample, which obviously is fairly invasive. So what we do now is we take a jug, which you can see over here, and we scoop the water where the whale just dove, and through that collection of water we can extract skin cells, fecal matter, and extract the DNA from that, never actually touching the animal.
Okay, that doesn't sound quite as sophisticated as what you see on CSI on TV.
No, I don't recall very many episodes of CSI involving fecal matter personally, but you know, in the world of marine mammal research, this is a fairly novel technique. But the researchers say it has so much untapped potential, from determining things like whale paternity, which is apparently a bit of a mystery, to the types of food that whales are eating in the winter and that might be attracting them here to the Salish Sea.
Wait a second, whale paternity?
Yeah, so basically killer whale moms seem to be the original helicopter parent.
I love picturing a killer whale hovering over her child.
Yeah, they're quite involved. So apparently they hang out with their calves well into adulthood. Gary, the whale researcher, joked that whale dads, on the other hand, are total deadbeats. His words, not mine. But essentially these whale dads have kids and move on. The thought is that eDNA could offer insights into which of these dads are actually siring offspring and which ones maybe aren't. So, for instance, Gary mentioned that maybe two or three dads are helping propagate an entire species. We don't really know, but the hope is that eDNA could, you know, provide insights.
So that all sounds really interesting, but why is it important to know about whale dads?
Yeah, so it's whale dads and it's everything else, right? So if we think about eDNA as CSI for the ocean, in CSI, information answers the question of who done it. But in the ocean, eDNA has the potential to answer questions about how exactly climate change is playing out beneath the waves. So, for example, food sources can move, and then suddenly you have whales foraging in areas they don't typically frequent, or they could be going there at unusual times. Basically, the researchers here are gathering eDNA samples to compare with previous biopsies in order to determine if their methods are actually effective. So they're sort of establishing a baseline.
So kind of like checking your math homework against the answers in the back of the book?
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good example. So here's Chloe Robinson, the group's expert in eDNA.
We focus on resident killer whales, but also humpback whales as well. The great benefit of focusing on these whales is already known. So this is actually a fantastic population to trial these non-invasive eDNA methods, because we already know what we should be looking for. So this is the only real way you can ground truth to know, yes, eDNA can do this. eDNA can, you know, eventually replace biopsies, because we actually have that hard data to compare it to.
So the reason humpbacks and killer whales are already so well-researched is because many of their populations in BC are either endangered or at risk, meaning there's fewer of them to study. And so researchers, because of that, have been able to build out a library of samples from most of the whales in these pods. I was surprised, and you might be surprised too, to know that, you know, there's only 75 southern resident killer whales left here in BC.
Wow. So what's driving this decline in that population?
Simply put, us. You know, it's hard to disentangle the current effects of climate change from previous human behaviors, but it seems fairly clear we haven't done a good job setting these whales up for success, particularly when it comes to warm ocean water. So the researchers say the drop in the southern residents really started in the 1960s and 70s. Back then, there was rampant capturing of killer whales happening along the coast of BC and Washington State, and a lot of the animals were caught and sold to aquariums all around the world.
For the southern residents, they took like 30% of the population from them, and they took young animals, so it left this big hole in the population. And then, of course, we got a taste for salmon, and there was historic overfishing, and we built up cities around major salmon-bearing rivers. So all these issues have left our southern residents in particular in a pretty precarious position, and I think it's our obligation to do what we can to protect them.
So this is a chance to make things right.
Yeah, in a way. What's really interesting about eDNA is that it could be useful in terms of helping whale populations flourish. So, for instance, if the researchers gather prey samples, which is a fancy way of talking about food scraps from whatever the whales are eating, they might be able to test those samples and determine exactly what type of fish it is. And not just, oh, it's a salmon, but it's a salmon from a specific river or from a specific waterway. The thought is that eDNA could allow scientists to close gaps in climate change research. Another example is, you know, we know salmon are affected by climate change, but we don't know exactly what that looks like or how it plays out in the distribution of salmon stocks. eDNA could quickly assess that by looking for markers of all the fish swimming in the water around a specific area. And details like that could be really, really useful because it could help governments and conservation groups focus their efforts and maybe produce meaningful change more quickly, which has this group excited.
Mm-hmm. I can feel their excitement, and just their love of whales is totally contagious.
I know. Who doesn't love a good old-fashioned whale? but, you know, it was funny. A lot of the researchers could trace their interest back to early childhood. So one of them that I spoke with, Brittany McLean, told me her journey into marine biology started when she was super, super young.
My career as a marine biologist basically started when I was 2 years old and watched Free Willy. I was moved essentially by killer whales on our coast, and that started for me of wanting to get into this sort of work.
What is it like seeing these amazing animals so close up?
It's a pretty breathtaking experience to see a whale in the wild so close, to hear them take their breath. It's amazing, the power that comes off of it, and you kind of don't realize how large these animals are and how majestic they end up being when you see them in their natural habitat.
And you know, Alicia, I can confirm they are quite large and they are quite majestic. It was very cool to be able to get to see them out in the wild like this.
So now that this group's gathered some eDNA on this trip, what will they do with the findings?
Yeah, so they certainly kind of have their work cut out for them. The researchers say the end goal of this project, like so many research projects, is to get their data out into peer-reviewed publications and to basically advance our scientific understanding of climate change. But it's striking to think of just how long that actually takes. Even with these faster methods, they say it could take almost 10 years to collect enough data to understand what our new normal is. Which makes sense, but it's an awfully long time when some of these animals are so at risk. At the same time, there is a bit of good news that I want to share with you. The southern and northern residents are in a precarious position, but the big killer whales that I told you about earlier, their population's actually growing, and Gary and his crew got to see this up close.
There's about 15 to 20 whales, which is a pretty big group for big killer whales. And excitingly, we have a brand new calf in the group too. On our way over, we were able to take photos of a whale known as T124A1, a female big killer whale, and she had a tiny little calf in tow with her, so always great to see the population growing.
What an experience. Ethan, take me on your next assignment when you're on that boat the next time, okay?
Yes, absolutely. You will be the first person I email for any future whale-related pictures.
Ethan Sawyer, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We have time now for some other climate stories in the news this week. an unseasonably warm winter in Ontario has impacted everything from ski hills to salt mines. Windsor Salt Ojibwe Mine says it's laying off dozens of workers. The company, which produces road salt, says there's been less customer demand during the milder weather. According to Environment Canada, climate change and El Nino are behind the warmer temperatures. A spokesperson for Windsor Salt says workers will be laid off indefinitely while the company monitors market conditions. Most of the world's fossil fuel emissions are linked to only 57 fossil fuel and cement producers, according to new analysis. Researchers with Carbon Majors database tracked emissions for 7 years since the 2016 Paris Climate Agreement. That's when governments agreed to cut emissions. But the data show most producers increased their output of fossil fuels. The three largest emitters are state-owned companies in Saudi Arabia, Russia, and India. Billie Eilish is calling out the practice of musicians releasing multiple versions of the same record to drive up sales. The singer-songwriter called the practice wasteful in an interview with Billboard. She then later admitted on social media that she herself has released different variants of the same album. But according to Billboard, the artist has done things like use recycled black vinyl and shrink wrap made from sugarcane. And of course, you can read more about climate change in the CBC What on Earth newsletter. You can subscribe to have it delivered to your inbox every week.
My name is Rudy Kelly, and I am an Aboriginal.
I am Chief.
My dad was a great chief of the Tsimshian Nation, beloved by his people. But at home, with his family, he brought anger and pain. He told me that to succeed, I would have to leave everything behind. Now I'm on a journey to find out who and what my dad really was. The Aboriginal is an all-new CBC podcast. Available now.
Now let's listen in on an imaginary meeting in an imaginary boardroom.
Fewer Canadians are very concerned about climate change.
Sorry, fewer?
Concerned
about climate change?
Yeah. Look for yourself. Look at
what about the terrible heat waves, the biblical floodings?
Less concerned. I don't get it.
Here, have a cookie.
More support for the oil and gas industry.
Those are the voices of five fictional CEOs of five fictional oil companies reading the results of a real report called What Do Canadians Really Think About Climate Change? As you heard, those fictional CEOs were pretty happy with the results of the report. And that scene is part of a new comedy web series produced by a Canadian group called Artists for Real Climate Action. Actor and producer Lisa Repo-Martel says she was prompted to create the group after a UN climate report that said humanity had 12 years left to cut emissions to limit climate catastrophe.
So that really put some fire in my pants. And in the spring of 2019, I was sort of watching the election rhetoric ramp up and climate was nowhere on the agenda. And so I just did a sweet little post on Facebook saying, does anybody want to join me in making some climate action propaganda in advance of the federal election? And I got all these takers, all these people who were friends of mine, but also just acquaintances and people I didn't even know. And 2 weeks later, there were 30 people in my living room. And our first campaign was the 2019 election campaign, where we made about 30 videos encouraging people to think about the climate when they voted and to make sure that their representatives had a plan for climate action or they wouldn't get their vote. And we worked with about 100 Canadian artists, a lot of celebrities, and we have not stopped since then.
Artists for Real Climate Action's latest project, you just heard a little bit of it. It's called The Big Oil Alliance. It's streaming on YouTube starting this week. So Lisa, what's it about?
The basic premise of this web series is that the top five oil companies in Canada have come together to take on the existential threat of climate change. But what they mean by taking it on and what their new hapless sustainability consultant means are very different things. She wants them to really do something and they just want to appear to be doing something. And the hijinks ensue.
So the Big Oil Alliance strongly resembles Pathways Alliance, which is a consortium of Canadian oil sands companies. Why did you want to satirize pathways?
Well, they are ripe for satirizing. We were brainstorming around what video project we wanted to tackle next. And it was just the time when the Pathway Alliance, they launched an ad campaign that was all over the place on YouTube and on the radio. And all of us were hearing it as we were taking our kids to school. A clear the air campaign where they wanted to assure Canadians that they were doing everything possible to move as speedily as they could to meet their net zero commitments. And that's not true. In fact, their emissions and their profits continue to grow at a healthy pace.
We asked Pathways Alliance about your satirical take on the work they've been doing. They haven't yet responded to us, but the organization has said that it's taking action to reduce emissions from the oil and gas industry. It says it intends to make a real positive impact and that it's spending money on new innovations. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think that may be true in the narrowest possible sense of the words that they say. They are investing a teeny tiny percentage of their record profits in things like carbon capture, and they are continuing to hold out the hat to the Canadian government to get subsidies and funding for these technologies. But carbon capture has actually been around for a long time, and it has failed to adequately be something that could actually be considered a solution to reduce emissions.
Now, I should point out that Pathways says on its website that it is on a path to reach net zero emissions from its operations, and it has said that it wants to spend $16.5 billion to build a carbon capture and storage network in northern Alberta. But Lisa, what are you trying to achieve by taking a comedic approach to subjects like net zero and carbon capture?
Well, I always think, and we think as a group, that comedy is just a great way to start a conversation. It kind of creates an instant bond between creator and audience. You know, you can't really trick or manipulate anybody into laughing. It's got to feel true on some level, even if it's, you know, exaggerated. And so that bond you create through laughter, I think, makes people just more open to your message. And things are not good out in the world these days. People are feeling very scared and worried and overwhelmed, and they are tired of being preached at. And we just feel that comedy is a great kind of low pressure way to start a conversation. Our main hope, just our mission with this goofy web series, is just to alert Canadians to be suspicious of the messaging that is coming from the big oil industry. These are the people who are creating, have created the problem, have lied about it for decades, and we just feel that they are not good faith actors in the conversation about how we transition economies away from their product. We just want to point out in a humorous way that perhaps we should think twice about letting foxes guard hen houses.
Do you worry at all about further dividing people? The series satirizes oil executives, but there are also a lot of working and middle-class Canadians who make their living in the oil industry. So does a video series like this risk further polarizing the discussion about the future of oil and gas in Canada?
You know, it feels like everything risks that kind of polarization and separation. But that's another reason why we chose the comedic route to express these things. I don't know what we can do about that problem, really. But we also, you know, as you said, take aim at the absolute tippy-top bigwigs of these corporations. And we are not in any way critical of people who work in the oil and gas industry and feel absolutely that those people should be protected and shepherded through any green transition without any sacrifice and loss to livelihood.
Has it brought you some joy doing this series? Have you found a way to laugh at some of these overwhelming topics and discussions that can feel quite divisive at times? Has it brought you some joy?
Yeah, absolutely. It's brought us joy. And in fact, I mean, what's also terrific about it, our group came together in 2019. We're just a bunch of actors and filmmakers who, you know, who cared about climate issues. But it really does your soul good to put your hand to something, to not just sit and stew and actually join a group, write letters, try and do things, and it really does ease any climate anxiety that you have. We've just totally had a blast, and we laugh all the time, and we feel like, yeah, we're putting any of that anxiety and worry and fear and anger into such a productive and kind of basically lighthearted place.
You're not the only ones doing this. There are other environmental groups and advocates who are using comedy to talk about climate change. Why do you think climate comedy is having a bit of a moment?
Well, it is better to laugh than to cry. I think also it's because of this polarization issue that you bring up. Like, people are tired of being preached at. They're tired of being scolded for their individual carbon footprint. People are just overwhelmed, and they can't take any more bad news. And so we also feel really optimistic about the possibility of an energy transition that is equitable, job-creating, and geopolitically safer, and all of these things. So we feel that the fossil fuel industry in Canada is really holding the country back from the clean, green, prosperous future that we all deserve.
Well, I hope you keep having fun and that you continue to find the funny in some of this. Lisa, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again, Lisa.
Bye-bye.
You can watch The Big Oil Alliance starting on April 10th. Just search for ARCA Productions 911 on YouTube. I'm Leisha Grabinski in for Laura Lynch, and you're listening to What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. I live in Saskatchewan, a province with more than 100,000 lakes and rivers. A short drive out of the city takes me past farmers' fields to a ton of large lakes to go paddling and swimming in the warmer months. Most of the time, water feels abundant here. But in reality, it's not. In fact, right now, Saskatchewan is in a drought. Across Canada, most provinces are dealing with extremely dry conditions. And we've been talking on the show about how leaders in places like Alberta are trying to figure out how to adapt. In Saskatchewan, Premier Scott Moe recently announced his strategy.
These drought years, the last few years, have made it abundantly clear that irrigation is key for us to improve not only our crop production, but to improve the value of the crops that we are producing.
Water for irrigation will come from Lake Diefenbaker, an hour and a half south of Saskatoon. When you stand on its shoreline, you feel like you're looking at an ocean. It was formed by damming a major river to help secure water for the province. It's a hotspot for sailing, but it also provides drinking water to communities, water for power generation, the oil and gas industry, and potash mining, but also irrigation to farmers. The plan now is to use more water from the lake for agriculture. Sean Jakes is with Saskatchewan's Water Security Agency.
One of the greatest needs for growing a crop is obviously water, right? And so, you know, what irrigation does is take away that risk or that one variable that is needed to produce a crop.
The whole project is expected to cost more than $4 billion. But many are asking, is this a solid climate solution? Brent LaRocque is director of environment for Métis Nation Saskatchewan. He grew up right where the North and South Saskatchewan rivers meet, which is directly downstream from Diefenbaker Lake. He's worried if we take more water from the lake, less will flow downstream.
The effects of climate change are becoming ever more pronounced. 2023 was a record year for low flows in the South Saskatchewan River system. It is concerning. The South Saskatchewan is drying up, and it really does feel like this project has the potential to, you know, accelerate those changes.
Métis Nation Saskatchewan declared a state of emergency last year in one of its communities downstream of the project. It was facing a water shortage. Brent is worried the situation will worsen.
The cultural value of being able to access food, the value that the river systems provide to our communities. You know, it's very difficult to put a dollar value to that. I mean, it's very easy to say how many dollars of GDP that it'll bring into agricultural sector. Now, I do sympathize with agricultural producers. My dad is a farmer, but there's the saying that you can't, you know, cut the bottom off of a blanket, sew it to the top, and think that you have more blanket. The supply of water is only going to continue to decrease.
Other Indigenous organizations have expressed concerns as well. The Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations says there's been a lack of consultation with Indigenous communities. Saskatchewan's Water Security Agency says it has met with 18 First Nations and Métis groups in the project area. Meanwhile, some farmers are casting doubt on the project too. Glenn Wright is a farmer and environmental lawyer near Vanscoy, Saskatchewan.
Even if we double the amount of acres that are irrigated in Saskatchewan, as this project is trying to do, that's still only going to bring us up from 1% to 2% of our farmland being irrigated. So I think there is a narrative that's being pushed by the people who are very much in favor of this project to try and couch it as a climate adaptation solution or something desperately needed by our agriculture sector. But let's be honest, this only helps a very few handful of farmers, say 100 or 200 farmers.
Sean Jakes says there is enough water to meet everyone's needs.
You know, in fact, more water evaporates out of Lake Diefenbaker than it would be used for this project. So, there is enough water for that. We believe it's sustainable.
But Glenn Wright says the Saskatchewan government should be working on solutions that address the root cause of climate change.
And I think really we're totally missing the mark here to think that we can just adapt to whatever climate comes. We are not putting nearly enough focus on mitigation, and that's actually where I think the most economic diversification and potential is for our economy, is to shift our economy in Saskatchewan from a polluting, high emissions economy to a clean economy.
In a statement, the government of Saskatchewan told me it's, quote, addressing climate change in a measured, responsible manner while continuing to grow our economy. We'll continue to keep an eye on the many ways Canadians are coping with drought. Remember, you can listen to all of our episodes on demand at CBC Listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a review. That's all for us this week. The show was put together by Danielle Piper, Vivian Luck, Rachel Sanders, Molly Siegel, Matthias Wolfson, and Catherine Rolfson. I'm Leisha Grabinski. Laura Lynch is back next week. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.